wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Denise Morris, your host for this July 19th Monday. This morning on The Old Mole, Bill Resnick talks to Susan Lynn about the corporate effort not just to sell to children, says Lynn, but to take over childhood and make them habitual consumers, to in fact instill in them a fundamental, deeply held impulse to gain pleasure and meaning in consumption. Susan Lynn wrote the book Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. She's an activist, founded the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood, now called Fair Play. And she is a puppet therapist for young children and made appearances in days gone by on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Desiree Helligers brings audio excerpts from events along the Red Road to D.C., a journey and campaign to call attention to the need to protect indigenous sacred spaces under threats from fossil fuel exploitation and dams that endanger fish runs. And to conclude the show today, we'll take a few minutes to honor the life of Sebastian Francisco Perez, the 38-year-old Guatemalan farm worker who died in the extreme heat of June 26th. Desiree Helligers brings audio from a July 3rd vigil sponsored by PICUN, CALSA, and other area organizations. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like The Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for The Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download The Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. And now, Bill Resnick and Susan Lynn.
Susan Lynn, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, Bill, I'm happy to be talking with you.
Susan Lynn is an American writer, a psychologist, therapist, and ventriloquist. She's an activist, founded the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. It's now called Fair Play. She's a research associate at Boston Children's Hospital, where she started as a puppet therapist and also made lots of appearances around the country, including on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. On top of that, she writes, including the book Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. Right now, she's working on a book on the impact of big tech and big business on children's values, their relationships, and their learning. It's coming out next year. Susan Lynn, first tell us about how our corporate elites have been and are continuing in more sophisticated ways to take over the lives and interests of children.
Well, children today are inundated with corporate marketing. I mean, honestly, just about 24 hours a day. It has infiltrated the clothes that they wear, the toys that they play with. Marketing in schools has escalated. I mean, even during COVID, the whole ed tech industry has become more and more powerful in children's lives. It influences the food that they eat, but also it influences their values. The primary value that's embedded in all marketing is actually incredibly destructive, and that is materialism and consumption and the false notion that the things we buy will make us happy in some kind of sustained way.
I recall, Susan Lynn, trying to talk to my granddaughter. She has lots of grandfathers. She is about 6 years old, and I have a lot of trouble sort of talking about things that are interesting to her in ways that are interesting to her. But anyway, I saw this kit she had. So I remarked, oh, those are such pretty colors. The fingernails look really pretty. And she said to me, now we're talking about something interesting. I never thought I would be interesting about fingernail polish.
Yeah, and I imagine that you never thought that you would be talking to a six-year-old who is so concerned about what her nails look like. But that's another consequence of kids being targeted with marketing. And one of the things that marketers do is that they exploit children's developmental vulnerabilities. And one of the things that they exploit is children's natural inclination to want to be and older than they are and to aspire to be like older kids. And so how that translates in marketing is that, you know, marketers know that kids 4, 5, and 6 admire older kids who are, say, 12 or 13. And so they target 3 and 4-year-olds or 4 and 5-year-olds as if they were teens or preteens. They know that preteens and, you know, early teens want to be like older teens, and so they target them with products that are actually, you know, more appropriate for older teenagers. And so there's even a name for this in the marketing industry. The acronym is KGOY, Kids Are Getting Older, Younger. But what the industry doesn't acknowledge is that kids may be getting the trappings of older kids, but their development hasn't really caught up. So younger, like your six-year-old grandchild, might wear nail polish or, you know, be sold sexualized clothing. But, you know, she doesn't have the emotional or the cognitive wherewithal to really understand what wearing that stuff means or the consequences of that. And one thing that happens that I think is really sad is that kids are jumping over middle childhood, which is, especially for girls, usually a really safe space where, you know, they've got their basic skills, both physically and intellectually. They're not worrying or focusing about, you know, what their bodies look like. But that's, you know, changed.
A lot of that is done with a great deal of professional care, right? You know, this is not just trial and error, although a little bit of it is, but they've got all kinds of people working with them, focus groups, right? They publish papers, some of the academics, on what sells. I remember once I was on the Berkeley campus and at the Berkeley Sociology. This is unbelievable, actually. The seminar was on marketing candy. One of the great research universities in America, marketing candy.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've gone to conferences, including conferences at major universities, about marketing to children, how to do it and the research behind it.
You're sort of just an observer critiquing it, I gather. They didn't.
Right.
They didn't invite you as a major speaker, I don't suppose.
No. You know, one of the most egregious studies, I was just looking back on this, I wrote about it in Consuming Kids, but it was a study done way back in 1998 that still has resonance today, and it was a study on nagging. It wasn't to help parents cope with nagging. It was a study to help corporations help children nag more effectively. It's called the nag factor.
Helping children nag more effectively.
Yeah.
Of their parents who buy things for them, I gather. There's so many horrible things. I mean, the horrible consequences of corporate invasion of childhood. Another one of my memories, which was pre-TV, this one, as kids, and I had a younger brother, we would play on the sofa and in the living room. I don't know what parents said. As long as we were out of their hair, they were happy. We would play with the cushions and stuff, and we'd build forts and put sheets on things and, you know, play with empty boxes. You know, you see kids in playgrounds and sandboxes curiously dealing with the materials and digging up and all the rest. And much of that now is they've sort of fashioned toys and materials and even like Legos. Although Legos seem to me to have some virtual kids to play with blocks. When you have the materials, it's a little different than just getting the whole thing made and you have so many options. I'm not sure about that. What's your sense of that?
Well, I think that, you know, the original tub of Lego blocks was an incredibly creative toy, really wonderful toy. But like a lot of corporations, I think that the powers that be at Lego got greedy. And so, you know, now it's hard to find that original box of Legos, and kids are marketed kits, and their kits link to other media properties. But it's not only that. Lego has apps for kids now. So on a phone, you can play with Lego apps. And I was at a marketing conference once where this guy said he thought it was so wonderful about the Lego apps, because you can't take a bag of bricks everywhere, but you could take the Lego app everywhere you go. And I just couldn't believe that he thought it was wonderful that kids were taking their devices everywhere and playing with them to the exclusion of engaging in the rest of the world and doing the kind of hands-on play that is so crucial to their development.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Susan Lynn. She's an American writer, also an activist, founded the campaign for a commercial free of childhood, now called Fair Play. She's also a psychologist, a therapist, working with children and their parents, using puppets as a ventriloquist puppeteer. She's also made many appearances around the world, including on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. On top of all that, she writes, including the book Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. And she's working on a book on the impact of big tech and big business on children's values, their relationships, their learning. We've just talked about that. It's quite fascinating, and I'm sure your first Consuming Kids, as well as the one that's coming out, has probably wonderful stories. We've had a few of them already about marketing to children, a few of them on the air today. Susan, you called it a hostile takeover. The title was Consuming Kids, The Hostile Takeover of Childhood. I guess you called it hostile because people are fighting back, maybe even children. I wonder if there's some kind of child's movement that's in some ways challenging the corporate apparatus.
Yeah, that's complicated. I called it the hostile takeover because the children weren't asking for it or have no say in it. I think it's a little, dangerous is too strong a word, but it makes me uncomfortable to talk about getting kids to resist marketing, because it's like blaming the victim. I mean, adults, including myself, are phenomenally vulnerable to advertising. I mean, there's, you know, tons of studies showing that. How can we expect children to resist it, especially when, as we, you know, alluded to before, corporations work with child psychologists to exploit all aspects of children's developmental vulnerabilities? So as kids get to be teenagers, it's more likely that they could stand up to corporate marketing, and some do. But we have to remember that the frontal cortex, which is where judgment sits, doesn't fully develop until the late 20s. So teenagers are incredibly vulnerable to marketing as well.
Parents, though, really can have an influence, right? And I think many parents are trying, especially now with, of course, climate change as such a great threat to their lives and children, and will, in fact, require us to be doing a whole lot less consuming of almost everything, because everything that we consume leads to more greenhouse gas emissions. It's sort of seeing a different form of life with much less consuming, even much less travel. But, you know, as Thoreau said, I've traveled widely in Cambridge. You can travel very widely without ever getting out of a library. it seems to me the very different lives are going to have to be led by most of the, especially the consuming classes of the world. Tell us how parents are dealing with kids to try and counter corporate values and the urge to consumption and the urge to look older and all the rest of it.
Yes, I will talk about things that parents can do, but one thing that it's really important for people to understand is that one family in isolation can't combat a multi-billion-dollar industry that is working day and night to undermine parents' best efforts. And we need to keep that front and center. That's why I started, you know, Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood, because it seemed, you know, to me that we really needed an activist organization to take on corporate marketing to kids. I left what was then CCFC and is now Fair Play in 2015, and I'm just incredibly proud of the work that that organization is continuing to do. So one thing that parents can do is, you know, go to the Fair Play website. It's fairplayforkids.org. And join with other parents who are fighting back and who are finding ways of working together to affect changes. So that said, there are some things that parents can do. And one thing is, especially, you know, for parents about to have babies or who have infants, one thing is not to rush to put them in front of screens. Because the primary goal of most screen content is to sell us something. That, you know, that's not true for everything, but it's true for a lot of things. And immersing kids in infancy and early childhood in apps and video games and the television programs that are now streaming on our devices, what that does is set kids up to become consumers. And it also deprives them of the kind of hands-on creative play that is so critical to their learning and to creativity and constructive problem solving. So one thing that parents can do is to make sure that their children have as much time as possible playing outside, if that's possible, and engaged with commercial-free hands-on toys and objects. The way that even, you know, tech companies, one of the primary ways that they market to kids is to get kids to fall in love with media characters. For instance, you know, take Elmo, who is certainly a fun character. But if a child, you know, sees Elmo on television and plays Elmo games and has lots and lots of Elmo clothes and paraphernalia, Elmo does become incredibly important to them. And so it's a way that corporations capture the hearts and minds of children. And then what happens is that parents see that their children like Elmo, and so they start buying their kids more and more Elmo things, instead of giving them, you know, opportunities to create their own characters or to explore the world with hands-on play and, you know, creativity.
I'm really not familiar with Elmo.
Elmo is from from Sesame Street.
My sense is that some of those great characters actually embody human values. They embody sort of sharing, trying to respect others, controlling your bad feelings, and being decent to others. Like, parents can promote group decision making in their own families, actually. Kids get older, they have a capacity to think about things and make judgments. You can be an authoritative parent and not an authoritarian parent. And you can have actually really democratic discussions and make decisions that way. And as long as they aren't really dangerous, Maybe the kids have a really important part of decision making. It seems to me that in order to get kids interested, like around Elmo, they have to present Elmo as a lovable character, and as a lovable character with these lovable, really decent values. There's this sort of contradiction in their practice, so that even though they're training the kids in consumption and pleasure through buying things and fun through going to Disneyland,
it just
seems to me that there are possibilities of maintaining values in that world.
Yeah, I mean, it would be incredibly hypocritical of me to just all out criticize children's media. I worked in television. I am so grateful to have had the opportunity to be on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I created videotapes for children about all kinds of difficult issues. The problem is not inherent in Elmo, the puppet, or the character. The problem is inherent in the business model that children's media relies on. And that is, there's not, you know, national funding for children's media. And so it ends up being a lot, if not for some companies, all about making money. And so the problem is not with the values embedded in Elmo. The problem is the values embedded in targeting kids with marketing, and the fact that characters like Elmo or, you know, Dora the Explorer, you know, these, you know, lovely characters are tools for selling kids stuff. That's what the problem is. And, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned global warming before, because, you know, if we're going to deal with global warming, we have to do something to limit consumption, and the values of consumption are embedded in children from early childhood, and they come these days from the tech and entertainment industries, the toy industry, the food industry, you know, all of those industries.
Susan Lynn, we're going to have to sign off. Examine consuming kids, the hostile takeover of childhood. Susan Lynn, my hope is that at some point kids rebel, as you pointed out, some teenagers rebel against the need to really change our lives immensely for the consuming classes because of global roasting, making the planet uninhabitable. It was only 118 degrees in Portland a couple of days ago.
How
about that? There's going to be a reckoning to corporate culture and corporate values and the behavior of growth at all cost industries. I hope that at some point I think people are going to realize to save their lives, they will recognize that they really have to root out those values and critique them and find other ways of loving that are much more fulfilling. So, Susan, your work is very important. Thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you, Bill.
Yeah, keep up the good work.
And you too.
That was Elton John, one of my very favorite songs when I was a kid, and I did love to dance around to the good music that was rock and roll back in those days. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and you're listening to KBOO 90.7, listener-supported community radio. I am Denise Morris, your host this morning. Next on The Old Mole, Desiree Helgers brings together audio excerpts from the events along the Red Road to D.C., a journey and campaign to call attention to the need to protect Indigenous sacred spaces under the threat from fossil fuel exploitation.
The following audio is taken from the Red Road to D.C.'s video feed, which you can find on Facebook at Our Shared Responsibility, A Totem Pole Journey. We begin with July 13th, Duwamish Territory, Seattle.
To open us up is Ms. Judith LeBlanc. She's the Executive Director with Native Organizers Alliance and leading this extraordinary nationwide initiative.
Good evening or good afternoon to everyone. And it is such a wonderful moment to be together around this virtual fire. You know, the Red Road to D.C. is a cultural strategy, it's a narrative strategy, and it's an organizing strategy. It's weaving all of those strategies together in order to ensure that we lift up the urgent necessity for immediate action to protect sacred places. There are countless sacred places, but in the places that the Red Road will visit, they are the places that have come so far and yet need so much more to be done in order to be taken care of for our descendants. When we first began to talk about this journey, the Lummi Carvers said, we want to carve a totem pole that can represent the moment, the decision point that we're in, not only as Native peoples, but as a part of humanity, that all have a common stake in the protection of Mother Earth. In many ways, the Red Road to D.C. is trying to build on what has become the work of generations to protect sacred sites like Bear's Ears, like Chaco Canyon, the Black Hills. And so we could not go with the totem pole to every area. We had to visit some places virtually, like the Arctic, Bristol Bay in Alaska, like the area of Mauna Kea, as well as other places. But the most important thing, I think, is that Nevada was included. Why? Because it highlights not only the struggle of tribal and Native peoples and community to protect sacred place, but because it highlights the dramatic collision course that we are on. That if mining and extractive fossil fuel industries are allowed to determine the future of Mother Earth, there will be none. We know that sacred places are being threatened by climate change and chaos, by careless development over time without concern about land or water and its impact the development will have on the future of that land and water, as well as careless, thoughtless government policies. But we're in a situation where the door is finally cracked open, that we do have the possibility of transformational policy change if we leverage the collective organizing that is being done on the ground, not just in the sacred places we're visiting virtually, but also those that we are visiting physically, and those countless sacred places across the country that are endangered. We need a fundamental change in federal policy. And so we're bringing this totem pole to D.C. to remind the Biden administration of their ancestral responsibilities to protect our right to the freedom of religion, our constitutional right. We are taking the totem pole to D.C. in order to say the time for us to be sitting at the decision table is now. How best to solve the problems of land and water and the right and freedom to religion than to have tribal nations sitting at the decision table. The UN offered up the solution of prior informed consent as the best way, the most democratic way for nations to relate to tribal and indigenous communities. And so in this journey, we're bringing the message also to the Biden administration that we're ready, that we're going to lean into the power, the inherent, the moral and the legal power that we hold as tribal nations and indigenous people to protect Mother Earth for all. I think that the issue of lithium mining in Nevada will help you all understand tonight why it is important that we are looking at the horizon, that we're protecting Mother Earth by looking at the horizon. There are short-term solutions that sound like they're going to ease us off of the total dependency on fossil fuel. But sometimes those solutions are false solutions and can create unintended consequences. And that's what the lithium mining in Nevada is all about. And I just want to end by saying there was an article in Forbes magazine last week or the week before about another lithium mining company who has decided, in order to skirt U.S. restrictions that they feel are beginning to build, that they will attempt to drill in the ocean, in the area that is under international control and therefore has no restrictions. And they're not even sure if there's lithium. But they're even thinking about trying to destroy the sacred waters of the oceans. So tonight you will learn much. I want you to know that we wish we could come to Nevada and visit with you all. We are sitting now on Duwamish territory in Seattle. There's a whole crew of people from Indian country that are outside in rented vans and cars waiting for us to get in them to head towards Lummi Nation, where tomorrow morning at 7, we will begin the Red Road to D.C. We will begin in a good way with prayers. Please follow us our daily ultimate Indian road trip across the country for 3 weeks and see on redroadtodc.org videos and live streams of the different ceremonies and gatherings all along the way from Lummi Nation to Washington, D.C. I also want you to know that we received confirmation that Madam Secretary Deb Haaland will be accepting and receiving the totem pole, the delivery of the totem pole on the National Mall on July 29th. So we hope you will tune in, come to D.C. July 29th, or tune into our live stream.
July 15th at a blessing ceremony on the Snake River in Nimi Pu territory.
The chairman of the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee, Samuel Penny, and really proud to see him and Shannon, others spearheading this Sama Orca conference and pushing for the dam breaching or dam removal. One thing I guess I'd like to say is people don't, I've never heard it mentioned too much, but those four lower Snake River dams were designed to be breached. Like they have an earthen part, they have a concrete part, so they can remove the earthen part and then allow the water to free flow better. And it's kind of like David was saying about this water here. Like this is all reservoir. Then the reservoir goes way up by a soat and past the soat in a little ways. So it's all slack water, and that's really detrimental to the salmon because the water is warm. Like this water is really warm compared to the clear water where it's free flowing. So like I said, I just appreciate the tribal council pushing this issue and the other tribes up and down the river pushing for it. So it's really nice to see. So here's Sam Penny.
Coach Mary, I'd just like to welcome everyone here this morning. As Julian mentioned, I first recall this issue of dam breaching came up before the Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee in 1999. So that was the very first time that we start talking about dam breaching. But before I begin, I'd like to thank Julian and the Nimi Pu Protecting the Environment, and also the carvers, the Healing of Tears carvers that have carved this magnificent totem pole. And, I've been to Lummi very many times, and, they have a rich history and culture and tradition there, and they've done this several times before on other either natural disasters or other issues that happened across this country, and have been advocating for protection of sacred sites all across this country. So, we commend them for all that they do. And I'd also like to just talk briefly about what was mentioned about, these slack waters. We just had a discussion the other day about warm water temperatures and the effects it has on all anadromous fish, including, lamprey and steelhead. So right now, for those that don't know, that they're releasing a lot of water from Dorshak Dam because these slack waters are so warm that it's fatal to fish. So, you know, predators and all along the route of the migration of anadromous fish are in danger of extinction. So that's why we're at a critical point right now. And the only way that we can get any action is to, as Julia mentioned, Orc and Salmon Summit last week, you know, to educate Northwest congressional delegations, because right now they're in key positions within the United States Congress to take some action now. And when I read about the significance of this magnificent piece, you know, it's 2,800-mile journey across this country, and then it will be at the Smithsonian National Museum of American Indian, where it will be a reminder to the current administration and to future administrations, as well as to Congress, that, you know, the plight of not only the salmon issue here in the Northwest, but the plight of indigenous people across this country and around the world. I think we've seen recently the issue of residential schools up in Canada, the issue of boarding schools here in this country, you know, missing and murdered indigenous women, missing children. So we just hope that, you know, the journey of this totem will be safe, as it was stated in the prayer, and that it will be a constant reminder to Congress and the general public that the indigenous people, we're still here, and we survived all the things that have happened to us, and we'll continue to fight for the natural resources that we're all so dependent on. I'd like to, again, thank all of you for being here with us today. Katsiyayo.
Lummi House of Tears carver Doug James.
Aichkwachil to each and every one of you. Sitki Katum Sanasnat. Really gratefully honored to be standing upon this land today. The ancestors that walked this land before all of us to come and mix our tracks with the ancestors and all of you that are present today. The spirits are strong. We come down off the line of Chief Siath, the Duwamish. We come off of our Lummi Nation. My brother Jewel really puts his hands out to each and every one of you. And he's thanking all of you that have had a heart prayer for him. You know, he's preparing to go through a surgery. But he wants to just raise his hands to all of us and of all of you. Just want to say Haishka to our elders that are here, to all the youth that are here. And it's to the youth that the baton is going to be passed down to. You know, we've heard it said, you know, that voices that got to be heard today are your voices. The climate change coming on and everything else, you know, when we're long gone in dust, what are we going to pass the baton down to our next seven generations to? What kind of lifestyle are they going to have? So we're just asking that each and every one of us has an obligation to reach out and let your voice be heard.
Shannon Wheeler, Vice Chairman of the Nimiipuu Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee.
The salmon are moving down from the acclimation sites or from their natural spawning areas, and they move down. And once they hit the slack water, they start running into problems. Once they hit that first dam, they run into another problem. So with sediment buildup and the channels that are reduced, predators that are in those channels now have a smorgasbord when the juvenile migration begins. And also, without the numbers of lamprey that outnumbered the salmon and steelhead both out of that system, that's reduced to the salmon and steelhead as the sources of food for those predators that are in the water now. So the sediment's an issue. And then you bring in the slack water, which we know, you know, the water is going to warm. And then even with climate change now, it's even warming at a faster rate, and we're experiencing a summer right now like no other. So we know that. Then we also know they hit the dams then. So once they hit the dams, they're either going over the spillway or they're going through the turbines. And so these salmon are going over those concrete barriers and through these turbines, and they're being injured. Their survival rate through those dams, a 50% survival rate on the way to the ocean. And they face all these pools going down with all of these similar problems all the way down. And then they're expected to survive once they get to the big game, the ocean, when they go through all of this gauntlet and they're maimed or they're injured or they're facing gas bubbles going down through there. And then we know the ocean conditions now are just another issue, another obstacle that they currently face. So then again, Congressman Simpson tells us that, well, I've looked at dam breaching 20 years ago. I laughed at it. You're going to take out the dams? No way. Those dams aren't coming out. There's got to be another way for salmon to survive. Well, at the Nez Perce tribe, we've definitely turned all the dials that we can turn in restoration. So Congressman Simpson's proposal proposes that through technology, through renewable energies, through different modes of transportation, that we can change things. We can do business better. And that's exactly what his proposal is meant to do, to start the discussions so that we can look at a better, stronger Northwest.
Also traveling on the Red Road to D.C. with the goal of meeting with Interior Secretary Deb Haaland to advance the cause of federal recognition for the Salila Wayam is Lana Jack, director of the Columbia River Indian Center. I spoke with Lana on July 16.
Indian people who have been under extermination for 500 years. The ongoing genocide against our people has never ended. Today, it is about the acknowledgement of the heinous crimes against us, whether it be the boarding schools or the policies like the Dawes Act or any of those that exterminate us as the original or aboriginal title holders all across this land. People always want to talk about Salila like Salila Falls, like she's gone and dead and buried, and she's not. She's a prisoner of war like myself, and we're getting down to the last hour here. What I intend to go back to Washington, D.C. and do is prove to the Department of Interior that my truths are solid, and to solidify that the broken promises made to my chiefs and my mothers, because my mothers negotiated between 1933 and 1948, their stay at Salila Falls. Federal Indian law protects us as well. They took our language. Yes, they cut our braids off. Yes, they beat us. Yes, for speaking our language. And this is a sad legacy, but even sadder for me, I come from a fish village where I can't even fish for sustenance. If I'm hungry, I can't even go out and catch me a fish without catching me a case to go to court somewhere. There's six different villages that are continuously occupied year round that need housing and water. We need a clinic. We need fulfillment of promises.
This has been Desiree Hilgers with the Omo Variety Hour.
Superman with the Prayer Loop song. Before that, we heard Desiree Hilgers and reports on the Red Road to DC. You can follow along with the Red Road to DC on Facebook at Shared Responsibility, a Totem Pole Journey. That's our Shared Responsibility, a Totem Pole Journey. You can Google that and you can find your way from there. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Denise Morris, your host this morning. And today we're going to take a few minutes to honor the life of Sebastian Francisco Perez, the 38-year-old Guatemalan farm worker who died in the extreme heat of June 26th, Desiree Helligers brings us audio from a July 3rd vigil sponsored by Pikun, CAUSA, and other area organizations. This segment was produced by Desiree Helligers.
My name is April Alvarez. I work at Pikun, Oregon's Farm Worker Union, and today we are here to honor Sebastian Francisco Perez's life. And not only just honor his life, but also ensure that we take action after the horrific events that happened. Sebastian fue un esposo, un hijo, hermano, y miembro de la comunidad en Ixcan, Guatemala. Sebastian was a husband, a brother, a son, and a member of the community in Ixcan, Guatemala. Today, we are here to take action. Hemos pedido a Oregon OSHA que adopte reglas de emergencia desde marzo. Pikun has asked Oregon OSHA to adopt emergency rules since March. Ahora que alguien ha fallecido por el calor extremo, quieren tomar acción. Now that someone has died from extreme heat, they want to take action. Nosotros exigimos que las protecciones deben incluir acceso a agua limpia y fresca, áreas de descanso sombradas, descansos pagados adicionales cuando la temperatura supera los 90 grados. We are asking OSHA to provide access to clean and fresh water for our farm workers, to provide areas with actual shade for our farm workers to rest, to actually have paid breaks additional, especially when the heat is exceeding 90 degrees. Vamos a pasar hojas para comprometerse a tomar acción y asegurar que Oregon OSHA adopte reglas de emergencia fuertes para el calor excesivo y el humo de incendios forestales. Here today, we are going to pass these flyers for all of you to take action and ask OSHA to pass these emergency rules now. My friend Cassie, who also works at Pikun, will be passing these along. And it's so important that we take action now and actually ask OSHA to pass these emergency rules. We have been asking OSHA since March to take and stand up for our farm workers, and they lacked to do that. The time is now. We have to do it now. So please, when these forms are given to you, please sign them, and we need to call OSHA and take action. Thank you all so much for being here. You know, I really appreciate everyone honoring Sebastian's life, but now we need to take action in order to make sure that this doesn't happen in the future to our farm workers who serve us every day. Thank you.
Now, if you all can help me do a chant and just follow along. ¿Qué queremos? Reglas de emergencia. ¿Qué queremos?
Reglas de emergencia.
¿Qué queremos?
Reglas de emergencia.
¿Cuándo las queremos?
Ahora.
¿Cuándo las queremos?
Ahora.
Sebastián Francisco Pérez, 7 veces. Sebastián Francisco Pérez.
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 Y ahora, para honrar a Sebastián Francisco Pérez y a toda su familia, queremos un momento de silencio. Muchas gracias a todos los que están aquí. Thank you so much for everyone that is here. We're going to go around with our pledge cards, so please fill those out along with the song for Sebastián Francisco Pérez. Thank you. Big round of applause for him and up there wherever he is. Thank you.
GoFundMe page for Sebastian's family on Pikun's Facebook and Instagram. Please, if you can support Sebastian's family, we would really appreciate it. Thank you.
The Honorary Consul for the Government of Guatemala, Martha Guendez.
Buenas tardes. This, unfortunately, we have lost a Guatemalan son. The government of Guatemala and myself are working together to support in any means with the family of Sebastián. I have here with me Sebastian's mother and his wife. Aquí tengo conmigo a la esposa y también a la mamá, la señora María, y ella quiere personalmente darle las gracias a todos ustedes que están aquí presentes por su amor, por su paciencia y por justicia por su hijo. Eso es lo que me dijo que dijera, pero ella quiere dárselos. So she wants to thank everybody here who is here for your love and for mobilizing and for justice for his son. That's what he told me. She told me.
Yeah, of course.
About the conditions for farm workers right now and the particular farm that he died on?
So all that's under investigation. It happened in St. Paul's. Everyone knows. We're working with OSHA. We hope that they do show up and they follow through. And it doesn't take somebody else's life for them to finally step up the game.
And you've been lobbying around this issue for months, since March.
Months, years. That's what we do. We're here to fight them, and that's why we're here to continue to fight for our farm workers and everyone in general.
Okay, and I mean, the weather's getting more and more extreme, and the impacts, I mean, the historic highs on the day that he died, it was, what, 115 degrees, something like that?
Yeah, I believe in Salem it was between 113 and 115. This is something we've been doing for years. But unfortunately, this is where we're at.
Yeah,
and we're mad, we're devastated, and we need OSHA to step it up.
Yeah, and how old was he?
38. Very young. Very young. He left his mother, brothers, and a wife back in Guatemala.
And remind me of your name?
Patty Verduzco, and I'm the communications director for PECUN.
Yeah, Patty, nice to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for being here.
El derecho de vivir sin miedo en nuestro país.
En conciencia y unidad con toda la humanidad.
Ningún cañón borrará el surco de la hermandad.
That was the classic Victor Jara anthem, El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, or The Right to Live in Peace. Jara's song was recently re-recorded by an all-star lineup of Chilean singers and musicians in the midst of the Chilean uprising that began in 2019, and that paved the way for the constitutional convention that was held in Chile on July 4th to overhaul the constitution that was enacted during the reign of terror unleashed by the U.S.-sponsored dictator Augusto Pinochet. Victor Jara was a renowned Chilean folk singer-songwriter whose mother was an indigenous Mapuche folk singer. Jara grew up laboring in the fields alongside his parents, and his music was infused with love and support for struggling indigenous farm workers in Chile and around the world. a theater director and teacher at the Technical University in Santiago in the wake of the U.S.-sponsored Pinochet coup of 1973, Jara was detained alongside thousands of others at one of two Santiago stadiums where supporters of the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende were crowded shoulder to shoulder before being sorted into lines to be beaten, tortured, murdered, and/or disappeared. Jara's hands were mutilated by Pinochet's forces before they executed him, but his music lives on and was sung by thousands in the streets of Chile this past year. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Community Radio. A big thank you to the KBOO staff who have kept our non-commercial community radio on the air 24/7 over this last year. It takes a labor. The Old Mole comes to you every Monday at 9 a.m. and thanks to our contributors and guests for making today's show possible, Bill Resnick, Susan Lynn, Desiree Helgers, Lana Jack, and the many dedicated activists walking the red road to D.C. You can hear The Old Mole on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or download the Old Mole podcast and listen on the go. An announcement coming up at Chemainsky Park, July 24th, that's a Saturday. Calling all Medicare for All supporters, show up for a big Medicare for All rally, family-friendly, permitted event with speakers, music, tables, ASL interpreting provided. They're asking folks to please wear masks. Dozens of cities across the country will be holding rallies on the same day. And the planning coalition of this event here in Oregon includes dozens of groups, along with Portland Jobs with Justice, Portland DSA, and Healthcare for All Oregon Act. I am Denise Morris. I've been your host this morning. Tune in next week for more news, views, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist perspective.